Alan Kring Productions presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, academic lectures in business and economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 4, for spring semester 2019. Lecture 24, delivered on April 24, 2019. The title of this lecture is Valuation by Cash Flows.
Tonight, Valuation by Cash Flows. This is a follow-on to what I did on Monday night when I began to give you the information about... I gave you some setup, and then I'm going on to give you some examples of doing cash flow analysis for the purpose of finding the value of a corporation. Now, ultimately, I will provide you with some of the spreadsheets from this PowerPoint presentation, but I will not provide you with the PowerPoint itself, because just as sure as I do that, it's going to show up on one of those rip-off sites that publish what they're not supposed to, and then I have to have lawyers send hate messages to them and have them freak out and give me IP addresses and all that. So I will avoid that by just giving you the PowerPoints, giving you the presentation. Now, just to quickly go back over what I want to do, this is the first thing is that when we're looking at the cash flows of a typical project, there are three phases. There's the first phase we call the initial outlay. That's before any of the product is sold at all. That includes buying the equipment. In other words, that is capital expenditures. And then there are those initial development costs, which are oftentimes operating expenses. Year zero has no revenues, but you can see operating expenses showing up. I had told you my plan for my last years is to open an all-night diner, Al's All-Night Diner and Last Stop Before the Apocalypse. Now, when I do that, of course, I'm going to have to make things nice in there, pretty. You know, curtains, dance lights for the dance floor, and also some nice stuff for the hotel that's attached for those who don't want to go on to the apocalypse and would prefer to stay at Al's Diner. And then, of course, I've got that side enterprise, the all-night soiree. So those are oftentimes operating expenses. And then there is that increase in net working capital. You're going to put inventory into the warehouses. You're going to prepay expenses like your insurance and all that. That will build your current assets up against your current liabilities. So there will be an increase in net working capital, which will, of course, bleed cash flow at the beginning. Okay, fine. Now we go on to phase two, which is the ongoing cash flows. The ongoing cash flows, the extra revenue this project is going to bring in, and the extra costs that it's going to create, and then the taxes. Now, the taxes, interestingly enough, will spill to the corporation as a whole, as opposed to everything else where you take only that project into account. I'll show you an actual example of this involving a Kellogg in a little bit. Now, also, your net working capital, I mean, in my examples, it stays flat because you build up 60,000 units at first, okay? That's a cash outflow. But then through the life of the project, you use 60,000, you bring in 60,000 more. And then at the end, you drain off that inventory as you close down the project. However, in real terms, there will be fluctuations in inventory brought in against inventory sold. It'll happen. It should not be a significant amount. As time goes on, you may decide to which more of your accounts payable that you will pay later than you did at the beginning. Oftentimes, companies pay bills much more quickly early on, and then they realize that they don't need to pay them so fast, and they can manage cash flow better that way. But for the most part, the changes in net working capital should not be that much through the life of a project, at least compared to what happens at the beginning and the end. And then you end it, the terminal cash flows. You sell off the equipment, net of any taxes, and then you have your shutdown costs, and those can be significant. Shutdown costs include remediation, include discharging people from their jobs and all that kind of stuff. Now, the shutdown costs, in some cases, you will pay companies to haul away what the equipment and stuff like that. They are going to, in some cases, that's going to include remediation. There are companies that specialize in getting rid of, on your behalf, stuff that is environmentally hazardous. Surprisingly, computers are an environmental hazard. A lot of electronic equipment is actually not something you can just send to the landfill. It is toxic. And so there are companies that will move it away, but they'll charge you. First, they'll charge you for moving it away. And second, they charge you for taking care of the EPA stuff that you prefer not to. Okay, and then there's your decrease in net working capital. You burn off the last of the inventory. You also are going to pay off the bills that are still hanging out there that you had incurred through the life of the project, things like that. And so there's going to be a drain on, there's going to be some net working capital change there at the end. Let me get you on. Operating expenses versus capital expenditures. Operating expenses are your day-to-day, week-to-week, month-to-month. Buying the wholesale at the wholesale price, that's cost of goods sold. Your light bills, your internet bills, your salaries, wages, and general administrative. Your depreciation is also going to be operating. Capital expenditures are the heavies. Those are the things that you cannot expense. You have to capitalize them and then depreciate. And that's an important thing, too. And I have seen this. It's not unusual at all for the depreciable life of an asset to not be the same as the economic life of an asset. So, for example, you could have a four-year project, but the depreciable life of something in the project is 5 years. A good example of that is in my own business. I have these extraordinarily expensive professional lenses. And I mean, their lifetimes, economic lives, are extraordinary. They're basically classics once you have them. But the depreciable life is 5 years or 3 years. So here I'm sitting with these things that actually have extraordinary economic value, but the book value of them is zero because I've depreciated them away to nothing. And so on my books, it looks like my assets are much lower than they are in reality. So, I mean, we do what we have to do with respect to our accounting rules, but we recognize that this can't be what we think of in terms of a project's life. I don't even know yet. I just got a trademark approved by the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office. I believe I depreciate the costs of getting that over a period of several years. But the trademark basically, I have to renew it, of course, but it's basically a permanent value in the corporation. Going on, here's your first kind of like mini spreadsheet. Operating expenses, plant redesign, $50,000. Notice that your operating expenses begin before the project actually comes to life in the eyes of the public. You've got operating expenses right out of the gate. And then and I didn't write it here, I apologize for that. We would have a project, in this case, that was $1.2 million, and I'm straight lining it over 5 years. So then you got your year zero, $50,000 in initial operating outlays. And then the depreciation strings out in years one through five at negative $204,000 a year to a salvage value of zero. So that's just a first, and I build this up. You'll see that over these slides, I'm building it as I go along. Few considerations just to think about. As I had said before, your sales initially, I mean, you're not going to pop up to great sales right away. You're going to have to build brand loyalty. You're going to have to build brand awareness. You're going to have to build brand preference, all those things. First, you have to get the awareness. Then you get the preference, and then you get the loyalty. That can take a long time. A bigger company is more likely to get it together fast. Smaller company, man, it's 5 yards or 3 yards in a cloud of dust getting up there. That's why a small company is really going to have a hard time if it doesn't find a way to attach itself to a big company. It helps, and that's why I went to all of the cost and the literally months and months of effort to get Amazon.com to accept my brand on my own storefront at Amazon. I would never go anywhere without being able to say, yes, Amazon.com sells my artwork. And that's just the reality of it. So it's not easy, that part. The average selling price of a product and its cost of production can change. It probably will. Your selling price is going to sag as competitors come in. There's also another thing that I want to mention very quickly here. Is you, as I said in the last lecture, there is no god of pricing. No one is going to whisper into your ear in the middle of the night, the price should be. Here's the reality of it. Here's your price right here. And here is, on the vertical axis, your revenue. If you charge a price of zero, well, your stuff will sell like hotcakes, but you'll have zero revenue. That's not a theoretical point, that's just reality. There's also going to be a point, a price, that is so high that no one will buy your product. The action happens between those two roots of the revenue function against price. As you increase your price, you're going to have some people say, I don't want your product, but at least you'll start to get revenue in. But eventually your price is going to get so high that you'll get more on per unit, but you will lose on volume. That is the price revenue curve. It will look like that, some way like that. Now, there is a sweet point somewhere, a price, where if you raise the price anymore, you'll lose revenue. If you lower the price anymore, you'll lose revenue. In economics, they call this the price elasticity of demand phenomenon. The trick is to find this price point. Finding it is a pain in the butt. How do we do it? No, focus groups are just absolutely ridiculous. That whole thing is worthless. Here's how we do it. We do sales. Okay, suppose that I say 10% off, and I'm here on the price curve. Well, if I take 10% off, I should see my revenues go up. My price was too high. But if I say 10% off and I'm over here, my revenues will fall. It's just purely a matter of sales. In fact, okay, let's raise our prices. Okay, if I'm here and I raise my price, I'll lose revenue. Ah, my price was too high to start with. But if I'm over here and I raise my price, my revenues go up. My price was originally too low. It's a constant probing back and forth. In my own business, what I will do sometimes is at two art shows nearby, near each other. Let's say one in Schaumburg, one in Bolingbrook. What I'll do is I will put up the same artwork at different price points. And I'll see at which show I had higher revenue. That will give me some information about where I am on this curve. If I charge a little more at Bolingbrook than I did at Schaumburg, and my revenues fall at Bolingbrook, that tells me my prices are too high to start with. But if I do that and my revenues go up, then I know that my price point was too low. It's a constant probing, and doing sales is one of the best ways we can do real market data instead of asking people in focus groups. Just the way it is. Competition reduces profit margins over time. Damn those competitors. May they all burn in hell. Except no. Don't hate your competitors. Well, you can hate them, but you also realize that the competition is going to keep you hungry. It's going to keep you lean. It's going to make you keep innovating. And it's going to tell you when it's time for you to quit if you can't keep up with it. These companies that are monopolies, the whole reason that we passed anti-monopoly laws in the late 1800s and the early 1900s was because monopolies are lazy. They just sit there on their fat asses and they have so much money that they can create barriers to entry so that they can keep being fat slobs. Microsoft, Google, Amazon, Apple. They're lazy. They're inefficient. You let that competition come in here. Matter of fact, it was some years back. The retired CEO of Coca-Cola said, if Pepsi had not been invented, we would have to have invented it ourselves. That's a good thing. That's healthy. Yeah, bring on the competition. That makes us keep on our toes, makes us keep innovating, not make stupid mistakes. Coca-Cola made a very stupid mistake in the 1980s. It got its clock clean for it. Who benefited? Pepsi. If there hadn't been a Pepsi, people would have still bought the crappy new Coke, and they would never have known that it was crappy. Oh, our sales are still up. That's because there's no competition. But with Pepsi there, Coca-Cola had to rethink and realize it had screwed up. Incremental revenue and costs. Okay, let's say that you're going to pull in $500 a year. $500 a year. Okay, here we go. Now you see three lines of the income statement. Incremental revenues, year zero, nothing. Years one through five, $500. Incremental costs, $50 in year zero, and then $150 in years one through five. And then your depreciation expense, $204 in years one through five. Notice, however, that in this example, this project has a four-year life. So it's going to be kind of the project I'll show you in a minute. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens with what's called the depreciation tail. Now here's the formula. This is not rocket science. This is plain arithmetic. Incremental earnings before interest and taxes, EBIT, is incremental revenue minus incremental costs minus depreciation. I've written it on the board. Now, notice in this example, I should point out that this is an unleveraged project. In other words, there's no debt that creates an interest expense in there. If it's leveraged, it's just that there's minus interest expense in there as well. Marginal corporate tax rate. We are theoretically in a progressive tax system. The higher the level is, the greater the tax on the last dollar in a progressive tax system. In reality, oddly, the very largest corporations on earth have a lower top marginal tax bracket than the next tier below them. And you will hear all kinds of gyrations and blubbering about, well, it's because of these tax, extra tax, and all this, we got to save these massive giants of the earth. No, it's purely the result of money, campaign money from the largest corporations on earth, fueling our greed-driven capitalist political system. Those big companies make sure that they get that there's a drop in their tax, marginal taxes from the level just below them. But anyway, your income tax is EBT. Now it says EBIT here simply because EBIT and EBT are the same if there's no interest expense. Income tax is EBT times the firm's marginal corporate tax rate. So if the top rate is 39%, if the company's top rate is 30, tax rate is at the margin is 39%, that second factor there is 0.39. If it's 34%, 0.34. Mine is 0.15. Now, here we go, down to the bottom line. Incremental revenues minus incremental costs minus depreciation buys us EBIT. Now, the line you're not seeing there is if there's interest expense, then you would minus interest expense after EBIT. And again, as I have cautioned many times, EBIT, earnings before interest and taxes, is another name for operating income. EBIT is the same as operating income. And again, after EBIT, there might be a line minus interest expense, which brings us to EBT, earnings before taxes, and then minus your income taxes at 40%. So your incremental earnings are going to be in year zero. You're losing money at the accounting profit line right off the bat. Negative 30, then 87.6, on through to year 5 at 87.6. This is as far as the accounting takes us. We do a couple of things to look inside of here, and then we go on. Cisco, a wireless home networking device called HomeNet. Cisco's got a great name. Even people, normal people, recognize the name Cisco, even though they don't use Cisco, because Cisco's a business system for the most part, a business-to-business thing. But Cisco wanted to step into an emerging market for wireless home networking appliances, HomeNet. Now, these will allow a homeowner or apartment owner to control major appliances via the internet. Now, when these started happening, they really didn't take off the way people thought, the way companies thought they would. You can control the temperature of your house from your smartphone. You can control the your coffee pot. Turn it on while you're at work so you have coffee when you get home. I mean, that was the beginning. And it was not embraced hugely, but upscale people did embrace it quickly. Trendsetter types, people who had enough money to do this and had appliances that were able to connect this way. You could run your TVs through internet connections, streaming video services, heating and air conditioning. This was the beginning of what you see now that's rather commonplace. Their competitor, who was already there, was Brant Quigley. Now, the advantage, of course, Cisco had was name recognition. Brant Quigley didn't have that kind of name recognition. And therefore, there was a play off the brand identification. Now, Brant Quigley doesn't sound like a sucky company. Brant Quigley sounds like the name of some duke in the British royalty. Well, Sir Richard Brant Quigley is here. It did sound reputable, but when you got that up against something called Cisco, I mean, Cisco could penetrate very hard, very quickly with its branding. So it was a play. Sales forecast, 50,000 units a year. Very simplified, of course. As I told, I'll caution you, I would do these. The product is going to have a four-year life, even though the depreciation life is 5 years. Kind of important. Now, they were going to be able to sell these to stores at $260 a pop. Now, the production would be outsourced to China at $110 per unit. Now, a little quick background on this, and I've done this in my years. When you have outsourcing from some place that's relatively reputable in China or on Taiwan, it is amazing. They will not only produce the product, they'll put it in they'll make the box for it and put the product in the box with the instruction manual all there. Pretty impressive. My first encounter was in the 1980s. There was an optometrist I knew and his fellow, fairly well-to-do person. Back then, the computer monitors were just these big blocks, and people who wore bifocals, the top was far vision, the bottom was reading vision, so where computer monitors would sit was not optimal for bifocal wearers. So these guys developed this little plastic thing that just clipped over the top of bifocals. It was called screen eyes. And it turned the far vision into intermediate vision so that people could look through the screen eyes straight at the screen and it would be in focus. It was brilliant. And so I made the arrangements with a manufacturing company on Taiwan to create an injection mold, to push in the plastic, the liquid plastic, literally, and then pop it open and out would come this little screen eyes. Well, we ordered, operating a set of prototypes so we could see what they looked like. We got them. They included for 87 cents for one unit. We got them in their own little pouch, red. It was kind of gaudy red, in their own colorful box for 87 cents a pop. So this is basically the whole nine yards. And in fact, they said, when you're ready to start distributing, you simply give us the names of where we are to send how many. So they were drop shipping them, fulfillment and drop shipping. The whole nine yards, all there from Taiwan. And so that gives you an idea. These are comprehensive outsourcers. And that's why it's really tough for American companies to compete with that kind of level of service that they did. Okay. They were going to have to verify that these worked in people's homes. They were going to have to work with appliance companies. There was going to be a lot of testing up front in the lab and working with companies. So up front before they sold one unit, there was a huge amount of legwork that had to be done. There was also going to have to be marketing done. You're not going to sell the product if people don't know there's a product. So, 7.5 mil of new equipment, depreciable life, straight lining at 5 years, tax rate of 40%. Now, this is not correct on this slide. The lab will be operational at the end of the first year, at the end of year zero. HomeNet will be ready to ship. They'll be coming in. They'll get the units, the prototypes from the outsourcer, the outsourcing company. They'll test them, and they are good to go. $2.8 million in rental costs for the lab, marketing, support, sales, and general administrative. Incremental revenues, we're going to need four items. We're going to need what you're going to sell them. How many, you're going to need to know your revenues. That means your projected sales. Cisco says $50,000 a year flat. And we're going to sell them to the stores like Best Buy and all of that at $260 per. So $50,000 times 260, revenues are going to get the $13 million. Costs, you're going to have 50,000 units made at $110 each, so your costs are going to be $5.5 million. Hence, your gross revenue, your gross income, is going to be $6.5 million. Getting the depreciation, you're going to drill $7.5 million down to a salvage value of zero over 5 years, straight line, $1.5 million depreciation expense per year. Now, these days, and I've simplified this terribly, you would be using something realistically like MACRS, okay? It is so easy to do in Excel now. You just say, all right, here's the depreciable basis at the beginning, and here's how many years, MACRS this, and it's just a function in Excel, and it'll just string out how much the depreciation expense is per year. You can tell it MACRS, sum of years, digits, whatever you want to, and it will give you the numbers. So it's no harder anymore to do a realistic one than straight line. But I do straight line here just to avoid that. Again, this project lasts 4 years, but the depreciable life is 5 years. So you're going to have a depreciation expense tail in year five, where there are no revenues coming in anymore. So here we go. This now pulls us down to a real, what we would see the accountants give us. This is what the accountants would give us. Incremental earnings, and now notice, this is earnings. We're not including the upfront expenses in year zero, but we're going to have years one through four incremental earnings of $1.92 million. And then in year five, we have no more revenues, so we are taking the full brunt of the depreciation expense after tax, which would be negative 900. That's not a bad thing, though. We'll see in a minute. This is, well, now here there's no interest expense, but if there were, it wouldn't matter. It's just a line, one more line. It's underneath EBIT, operating income. This is where the accountants can get us. It notice something also, absolutely critical to the difference between accounting and finance. Accounting is going to show nothing in year zero about the cost of the capitalized equipment. Guarantee you, you're going to pay that money. Whoever's selling you your equipment is going to want a check. And so there's real blood money pouring out in year zero. And yet, you don't see it on an accounting income statement. Up here, we just start depreciating. We don't recognize that that depreciation is just a representation of the real smackdown you took when you wrote a check in year zero. Doesn't affect the cost of earnings, though. That giant check you wrote for that factory or that giant or that big, huge truck or whatever, not that big, huge lab that you built. Okay. And here I'm just repeating what I've said before. Depreciable life really isn't all that connected to economic life. Now, I will get blowback from the accountants. Well, it's pretty close. We do it like, no. I mean, if you're telling me that I've got equipment that has a book value of zero after 5 years, but that is equipment that is worth a fortune, give me a break. That's not going to happen. Honestly, I don't know yet, and the cost of getting the trademark that I got through the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, I think that you have to amortize it over a period of years, 3, 5, I don't know. But when you think about it, that trademark is of value to the company forever, as long as I keep it up to date and renew it if I have to. So amortizing away things like a trademark or something like that, that's just nonsense. I'm saying on the books of the corporation, I have no value. That in itself is of great value, especially if the name recognition goes up on that trademarked thing. Okay, here we go. This is not the name of a real corporation. It represents a real corporation, but not the actual name of it. This is about the beginning of IOTA, the Internet of Things appliances. And as I told you on Monday, there is an internet that you don't see. You use it, but not directly. It is the internet of your things that talk to each other and talk to their motherships, their mothers and fathers. So when you make your coffee maker very likely tells the company your coffee using habits. There are refrigerators now that order more food for you when you get low on the foods it figures out you use. So in other words, in the morning, you take a snort of milk, and then you go to work and you say, damn, I don't have milk for tonight. You go home, yep, no milk. Ding dong, here's your milk, sir. Yes, that's here now. The Internet of Things has been building for a long time. They help you, but then they tattle on you. They tell everything that you do. Alexa listens to you, and then Alexa tells what it hears, even when Alexa is asleep. You see, you are the beneficiary of things that you're not really paying for, but you are. You see, if you are not the customer, you are the product. You, sir, are on a farm. You are not the farmer, but you get fed every day. You have a nice place to sleep. In fact, sir, you are a cow. Moo. Now, you see, the cow doesn't make decisions about what to say. I need hay. Moo. No, it's provided. I need this crap, shoveled out. No, you don't have to say it. It's provided for you. And in exchange, you become that beef brisket that's in my smoker for 13 hours getting delicious. That bark on the top, I use brown sugar and a little bit of cayenne. Oh, anyway. Okay, so you keep that in mind. Yeah, this is great. Those mobile phones that are tracking everywhere you go, where you stop to sit, where you stop to take your crap, where you eat and all that. Yeah, that's all the Internet of Things. It doesn't need your permission. It's taking care of you. This is one of the first companies that was doing the development. The internal guts of the appliances so that they could talk to each other and to other places on your behalf. This company projected 40,000 units and a four-year life of the project. It was 4 years, and it was actually, in retrospect, it was not any 4 years. The technology was moving so fast from about 2010. I mean, it was like 3 years, and this stuff was obsolete. There was all new stuff coming in to play. And then we were having some really major problems with bandwidth. In about 2012, these sports stations like ESPN were just drinking bandwidth with these ridiculous high definition and all those graphics that are in those sports shows now. But anyway, that's another story. Okay, they could sell them to stores at $200 a pop, their IOTAs. And they would cost $90 to produce. So in other words, your gross margin on sale would be $110. They were going to have a lab to test these. This was not going to be something that just popped out working. There were all kinds of problems. They had to rent lab space, but they had to also buy $6.5 million worth of equipment. Depreciable straight line over 5 years. Lab would be operational at the end of year one. At that time, IOTA would be ready to ship. They expected to spend $2 million a year renting the lab, doing marketing, and doing customer support, which is hugely important. Whether you're B2B or B2C, you need customer support, especially for anything electronic. You got to be there 24/7 to answer questions from your customers. Forecasting it, first we'll need the incremental revenues, incremental costs, depreciation, and marginal tax rate. Okay, they're going to sell 40,000 units at $200 a pop. That's $8 million in. Cost of goods sold will be 40,000, those 40,000 units at $90 each. So that's 3.6 million out. So they're going to net off that 4.4 million. Depreciable basis, straight line. It does, like I said, it doesn't really matter what you use. Excel can do it. But you're going to take 6.5 million initial, bring it down to a salvage value of zero over 5 years of depreciable life. That's $1.3 million a year in depreciation expense. And again, this is a four-year project, but it has a five-year depreciable life, so you're going to have a one-year tail on the depreciation. Happens all the time. I mean, I had projects, those low-income housing for the elderly. I mean, those things had a depreciable life 20 years. They were gone in 10 years. You know, we built them kind of cheap, so they fell apart. Yeah.
Where do you get the basis from?
That was how much it cost up here. $6.5 million. If it's something that's going to last more than a year, it's going to be capitalized. In other words, you have to depreciate it. So here it is again. The earnings. Notice this isn't the whole cash flow, because we haven't recognized this is what accounting would show you happened. This is what accounting would show you happened. That ain't what happened, though. There was stuff happening in year zero. Have you, sir, ever eaten spicy food?
Yes.
Good. Now, have you ever eaten spicy food when no one was around?
Yes.
Good. Okay, so they didn't know anything was wrong until the next day when you started making noises that sounded like alien invasion sounds. Okay? That's the accounting. They know only the backside, if you will. They don't know what happened before you started crying and started talking about, you know, speaking in foreign tongues and demonic languages, you see. Good. $660 a year for 4 years, and then in that tail year, you got no revenues supporting it, so you got a loss on the books of $780,000. And again, the cost of the equipment didn't do anything. It didn't do anything. Okay, now I want to take you down here real quick. Kellogg. Are any of you gluten-free eaters? Okay, gluten-free is a nice way of saying horrible. I mean, it is awful. It has a very bad reputation for being tasteless, difficult to work with, and all of that. Trust me, I've made gluten-free pie crusts. They are they'll use anything but wheat. There was this flour that I was, instead of wheat flour, I was just going to get some gluten-free flour, and then I realized it's cauliflower. They made flour out of cauliflower. I almost hurled right there. You can get all these weird kinds of flour. It just doesn't have a good taste. But the funniest thing is that there are foods that are naturally gluten-free, but companies are afraid to say gluten-free on the packaging because people have such a negative sentiment about the word gluten-free. Barbecue sauces, many of them are gluten-free. I mean, honey's gluten-free. There are lots of juices that are gluten-free, but they don't want to put that on the packaging because people will say, oh. Kellogg wanted to put its name on gluten-free, high-fiber products to get people to trust that it was Kellogg, so it might be pretty tasty. So they went about designing gluten-free, high-fiber breakfast pastries in this world of ours. Okay? That's risky, but they were going to do it. Put the Kellogg name on it, maybe people will try it. Of course, gluten-free is for celiac disease, and high fibers for people who can't take a crap very well. And so we were in a very risky territory here. Can we market this broadly enough that it will make us money? And understand that to actually do it, Kellogg wasn't just going to say, we're going to throw something together and call it Kellogg. They were actually going to try to make it work. Spend a lot of money, R&D, spend the money to market it and all that. Okay. The product launch before that, they were going to spend $15 million to make this product so it really did deserve to be called a Kellogg product. Pre-tax on the whole corporation was going to, without this project, it would be $460 million at a 40% marginal tax rate. If they do this project, that's going to knock $15 million off pre-tax for Kellogg. Watch what happens. Without this product, Kellogg would pay $460 million taxable income at 40%. Kellogg would pay $184 million in taxes. With this product, Kellogg's pre-tax would be 460 minus 15 million for 445 million taxable. 445 million taxed at 40% means a tax bill of 178 million. Oh, look. Without the product, Kellogg paid 184 million. If they go ahead, Kellogg pays 178 million. That's a tax shield. 184 million minus 178 million, there's $6 million that Kellogg would not pay in taxes. Well, you know what? 15 million times 40 times 15 million times 40%, there's your $6 million. So in other words, the tax shield is $6 million. How much you pay, how much you spend, 15 million times your marginal tax rate. That's what Kellogg saved in taxes by doing this. So this actually is an incentive to move forward with projects. Those operating costs of $15 million, that really wasn't $15 million because you saved $6 million in taxes. Okay? So that means that it wasn't $15 million, it was really $9 million was your upfront cost. You remember that. Tax Shield is going to be your helper in this. Now, this is Harbor Tool. Now, are you familiar, do any of you ever go to Harbor Tool? We've got them around the area. They had a reputation of low-cost tools, but they were cheaply made. I mean, I haven't gone there in years, and I've been told it's a lot better now, but I haven't been there in years because I bought a wrench and just snapped the first time I tried to use it. The Harbor Tool has been trying to do. Did I write pastries there? I wrote pastries there. This wasn't about pastries. Anyway, there was an interesting idea. And I think this, I wrote this wrong, but imagine toolkits, okay. Sir, do you have a toolkit? You do. Uh-huh. Now, do you have a toolkit? Sure. I mean, it's a manly man thing. As Arnold Schwarzenegger said, don't be a girly man. He actually said that, and he got by with it. If I said that, I'd get beaten crapless, deservedly. But here was the interesting idea. Imagine a toolkit for women. It's not, oh, daisies and dainty thing. No, it was just simply the handles were built for a woman's hand. They were slightly different from ergonomics point of view because of slightly different motions that women would use. And it would be, in a way, it would be a fully functional toolkit, but it would be aimed at another market that traditionally doesn't carry toolkits. The idea was actually brilliant in its time, but we also had some disasters when other companies tried to go down this road. So that's all I have for you.